chapter 4. If you have an outline, you see I've entitled our message this morning, Finding Rest from the Restless One. Last night as I was sitting downstairs thinking about the sermon this morning, upstairs was my five-month-old granddaughter. And at the moment, she was crying and wanting something. And I was thinking about the title of this as I was listening. Who do you think was the restless one upstairs there at the moment? Could have been. Okay, we hear a baby crying and we think the baby is restless, right? But I could imagine in my mind the scene that was going on upstairs. Kim, the baby's mother, was probably more restless than anyone, including the baby, unless it was Susan. But the mom was the restless one trying to give rest to the babe. And in a similar way, we're going to see that in our text this morning. Just kind of an analogy for finding that same thought. So we're going to begin reading in chapter 4. Let's review a little bit. We've been kind of reviewing about every week to kind of see the picture as the story progresses through the book of Ruth. And looks like next week we'll finish up the book of Ruth, so that didn't take long, did it? The book of Ruth, Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion find themselves in a famine in Bethlehem. They go to Moab. While they're at Moab, Elimelech dies. They have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, marry. And before you know it, both of those boys die. And Naomi is left a widow and without two sons. She's left with two daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah. They're there 10-plus years, and she decides finally to go back home to Bethlehem, to Judah. She's heard the famine is over and that things are going well as far as the weather and the crops. So she decides to go back. She tries to get her daughter-in-laws to stay behind and just stay with their own people. Orpah, one of them, does, but Ruth will not. Ruth has committed herself to staying with Naomi and making Naomi's people her people, embracing Naomi's God as her God, and they go back. They go back at the beginning of the barley harvest, which, if I understand it right, a few weeks after the barley harvest is over, the wheat harvest comes into harvest, and so they're there at a good time, going back at a good time. But Ruth and Naomi, but perhaps particularly Ruth, is sort of in a predicament. Ruth is a Moabitess, and she's coming back to live with the people of Israel. Naomi perhaps has very little, if anything, when she comes back to Judah. And the outlook for her obtaining very much is pretty slim. And the outlook for Ruth's well-being is perhaps slimmer. Ruth takes the initiative and wants to go and to glean the scrap barley behind the reapers, which is the custom in those days for poor people. And Naomi encourages her to do that. And it just so happens that unknown to Ruth and unknown to Naomi, that Ruth happens to come across and to work, ask permission to work in a field belonging to a man named Boaz. Boaz is a relative of Naomi's deceased husband, Elimelech. The people in the town and the people in the harvest, there's something about Ruth that has caught the people's eye. And we see little glimpses of it throughout the story that Ruth is a kind woman. She has been good to her mother-in-law. She's an industrious woman. She's not afraid to work. She's not afraid to do something, to take the initiative in trying to better herself. there's something about Ruth that is attractive to people, and people notice her. And people, it seems, admire her. And it doesn't take long for Boaz, when he comes to check on his harvest, to notice her as well. And he asks who she is. And they tell him, and Boaz sees to it that Ruth has a favored place among his workers. He sees to it that she has plenty of grain to pick up, to carry back for her and Naomi. He lets her eat with his workers, and Ruth goes home with an abnormally amount of barley, and Naomi sees it, and Naomi knows something's up. There's no way you should have been able to get this amount of barley gleaning the scraps behind the reapers. So Naomi asks her the most obvious question, where did you work? Where did you glean? Who was it that was so kind to you that you were able to pick up this much barley? And she said, well, it was a guy named Boaz. And Naomi, at that point, it seems like for a little bit there, Naomi begins to kind of put things together. And Naomi begins to remember that, yes, this fella is our kinsman. And so she devises a plan for Ruth to put those thoughts in Boaz's head. That Boaz, it looks like Boaz is already attracted to Ruth, and so to put the thought in his head that maybe I could fulfill the obligation to redeem her. So he does so, and he's going to. And Ruth goes back to Naomi that last night, or the next morning, and tells Naomi what has happened. And in chapter 3, the last verse, we'll read that verse first. Then Naomi says, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest until he has settled it today. So Naomi sees what she thinks, and of course we know she hasn't even seen Boaz, but she thinks Boaz is going to be restless. Boaz will not rest until he sees that this matter is taken care of. So we take up in chapter 4, we'll read the first 12 verses. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. And the closest relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself, you may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the matter of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. And all the people who were in the court and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel, and may you achieve wealth in Ephratah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord shall give you by this young woman. And we'll stop there. A couple of things I want to sort of talk about a little bit, and it's hard to know exactly the importance of some of these things, but also to just think for just a minute. First of all, let's think about land. Let's think about a culture where agriculture and farming was the most important vocation. Almost everyone was involved in agriculture to some extent, into growing crops or raising livestock. In our day, and for the last 100 years or so, maybe even longer, there's been what has been called a specialization of labor, where people hone in on one particular thing. Someone may work in a factory that makes skill saws, like what used to be in Heber. And that's all they do. They don't grow their own crops. They don't raise their own beef. All they do is make power tools. But they use them, and someone else may raise beef. So there's a specialization of labor that takes place that generations of people have been raised without really knowing what is involved in growing the food that they put in their mouth, especially if you live in the inner city, big cities. That wasn't always that way in this country. You can still find people who are old enough to remember when pretty much a lot of people that they knew, including their own families, was involved in raising some of their own food to some extent, maybe perhaps all of it. And that's the way it was in the nation of Israel 2,000-3,000 years ago. Land was important. And it was important because if you had land in your family, it was important to have land because you needed land to raise your food. There were two things that could happen that would hinder this from taking place. One was that the people who owned the land, through whatever circumstances it may be, could no longer farm the land. They may were sick, they may have been in poor health, they may die, or what would happen. Or in some cases, a famine might come along, and they can't farm their land. The second thing that could happen is the land could be so neglected that it was almost unfarmable for a period of time. And it looks like in the case of Elimelech and Naomi, both of these things had taken place. There was a famine there that caused Elimelech to leave his land and go to another country. He didn't take care of his land, and his land certainly didn't take care of itself. So that is a situation there with that. It was important for land to continue in families so that it would give families and their descendants the opportunity to take care of themselves. And the nation of Israel and their laws made provision for that very thing. If someone had to sell their land, then there was a period of time where the land could be redeemed. The land could be bought back and redeemed so it would stay in that particular family. We have situations like that and provisions, I should say, for that in a similar way, even in our country. If someone loses their land because they do not pay the taxes on it, your real estate tax, And the land, if you don't do that for so many years, the land goes back to the state. And the state will sell it. But even if the state sells it, those people have, I think it's 2 years, that they can redeem that land. And they can buy it back. So these are sort of things that go that were present and going on in the nation of Israel, and in particular in the family of Naomi and Elimelech. Another thing I want to us to think about a little bit is just the insight, what to me appears to be the insight of Naomi. Naomi, we see several sides to Naomi, and we see several things about her, but it seems like one thing that I notice about Naomi is she is perceptive. She sees through things, and she sees what's really going on, and she sees ahead how to plan and how to do things to make things work out. And we see that in her relationship with Ruth, and especially when Boaz comes upon the scene. I just think about two pairs of words you see on your outline. The first is right or responsibility. We're going to see that the redemption of Elimelech's land and the redemption of Ruth was a responsibility that someone had. It's a responsibility. It wasn't just an opportunity. It was a responsibility that the kinsman had. And where there is responsibility, and I've tried to think of exceptions to this, and maybe someone can, but it seems like to me that where you have responsibility to be taken on, you also have a right from someone else. For instance, if I have a responsibility to take care of my wife, that's my responsibility. My wife has a right for me to take care of her. You follow that? She has a right to that because I have a responsibility to do it. So think of those words and similar words, opportunity or obligation, kind of the same thought. In this story, I want us to look at five things. And five things that are general statements. They're specific, but they're sort of general. They don't take into a lot of detail. And I want us to make the application of Jesus Christ as our Redeemer, redeeming us from sin. And see if you can see in each of these five statements Christ doing these things for us. Okay, the first one is this: the Redeemer is single-minded in his focus on redeeming Ruth. The Redeemer is single-minded in his focus on redeeming Ruth. We see where Boaz, when he talks to Ruth the night there at the camp, he tells her, he says, "You don't do anything. Tomorrow, I'll take care of this." Right? He's got one task that is top priority on his list of things to do tomorrow. And it looks like that's what he's focused on. That's what he's going to take care of tomorrow. Not next week. Not when he gets around to it. Not when he gets all the money from his barley harvest put in the bank. Tomorrow, I'll see to this. When Ruth goes home to Naomi, what does Naomi say? "This man will not rest until he sees this through." He is single-minded in his focus. And we see in chapter 4, the very first verse, the next day he goes to the city gates and begins the process of taking care of this. Single-minded in his focus on redeeming Ruth. And we can see that. Can you see that in the work of Christ, the earthly ministry of Jesus Christ? There was one focus. He did a lot of things, but he came to seek and to save that which was lost. He came to redeem. His focus was on that in his when he was on the earth. Number two, the Redeemer is careful to fulfill all legal requirements to redeem Ruth. The Redeemer is careful to fulfill all legal requirements to redeem Ruth. Boaz goes to the city gate. And it's not long after he's there that this certain man that he's looking for walks by. How do you think Boaz knows where to find this guy? I think if he didn't already know, he made it a point to figure out where this guy is going to be today. Where is he going to be? What time does he come into town? What time is he going to be around at this certain place? And he makes it a point to be there. When he gets there, he asks the guy, "Hey, come and have a seat. I want to talk to you." And he gets, the text says he gets 10 other men around to sit and to listen to the discussion. 10 people to be witnesses. And it appears that, well, you can read that their law required 10 people to make a quorum, you might would say in our terminology. 10 people to fulfill the need to establish a legal transaction. So Boaz sees to it that these 10 men are there. He's not just checking the guy out. He's not just feeling him out. He's making provision for, at that moment, for everything to be accomplished in one sitting. He's having it taken care of in one time, not just haphazardly doing something and coming back and getting with the guy later on or whatever. He takes the 10 men. He tells the man, "Buy the land. You're the next of kin. Buy the land. Buy it in front of these witnesses. It's your responsibility. Here it is. Here are the witnesses. If you want to buy it, buy it." Now it looks like, and I don't know how to take this, but it looks like Boaz may be strategic in how he's presenting the evidence or the information, right? Because he doesn't say, "Here's this widow woman, buy her." He starts with the land. Now why that is, I don't know. You know, I don't know. You know, the thought came to me, maybe he's hoping the guy doesn't want the land, but he might be interested in the woman. But if, so if he doesn't want the land, he won't even tell him about the woman. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it worked. But we just know that he talks to him about the land first, and I don't know if he's disappointed that the guy wants the land or if he's falling into his plan that the guy wants the land. I don't know. But he offers him the land, says, "Here's the land. It's your responsibility of next of kin to redeem this land. Do you want to do it? Here are the witnesses." And the guy said, "Yeah, I'll do it." Like I said, I don't know if Boaz is disappointed or not. But then Boaz takes the next step and reminds him or informs him of perhaps something else that he isn't aware of. It's not just the land. There's a widow woman that you will have to marry and raise up children for her dead husband so that their family can continue. Not just the land. You're going to take the land. You've got to take Ruth with her, with the land. And he says, I can't do that. But Boaz is seeing to it that everything is in place. All the legal things are here. Now you think for a moment about Christ, about Jesus fulfilling all of the law and providing redemption for us. Jesus came on the earth and he lived a perfect, sinless life, fulfilling, he said, all of the law. All of it was fulfilled. All the prophecies were fulfilled. All the promises were fulfilled that had been foretold about the coming of Christ were taken into account and meticulously fulfilled and taken place. Number three, the Redeemer is ready and willing to make any sacrifice to redeem Ruth. The Redeemer is ready and willing to make any sacrifice to redeem Ruth. Boaz tells the kinsman redeemer, the closest relative, he said, if you want redeemer, then I will. He tells Ruth prior to that, I will redeem you the night before. I will redeem you. You don't worry about it. You go home tomorrow, I'll take care of this. I will redeem you. He tells the man, here's your opportunity, here's your responsibility. Redeemer, if you will. But the man would not do it. Now, why will the man not redeem the land and Ruth? He says, lest he mars his inheritance. That's what he said. But in just thinking about this, I want to suggest three reasons why this man would not do this. And keep in mind that this is not just an opportunity for this man. It's a responsibility. He has a responsibility to redeem the land. He has a responsibility to raise up seed for his dead relatives. The man won't do it. Here's one possible reason. Is the man's married? Does that affect his decision any? I would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, if I had been that guy and I had the opportunity to redeem some land and to take another wife, I would have said, are you kidding? Susan will kill me. I'm not doing it. Right? So it could be that the man won't do it because he's married and he doesn't want to create trouble in his own home. The problem with that idea is he doesn't say that. He says, if I do it, it'll mar my inheritance. So that may not be it, although it may have been a reason. It certainly would have been something to think about. Second thing that perhaps might have come into play, and this could have marred his inheritance. If this man's family are not too fond of Moabites, and they are bigots or racist or whatever word you want to use there, and he comes home with this Moabite woman that he's redeemed, he may get disowned by his father or his family. And whatever inheritance he would have had in his family may have been in jeopardy because of their feelings toward Moabites. So that could have been it. The third reason, and this is perhaps the one that I sort of lean toward, like I say, I don't know which, or maybe it's something totally different than any of these three, is that the man doesn't want to invest the time and the energy to make this happen. Now here's what's going to take place if he does it. He's going to spend some money to buy some land. He's going to take this young woman to be his wife. They're going to have children together. He's going to have to spend some money to take care of this land that he just bought. He's going to have to keep it up. He's going to have to take care of the land, see that it's productive. And someday when this new son of his is grown, the young son is going to get it all. And whatever he's put into it is going to be gone. Or at least it's not going to be his. He's going to be doing all of this work and all of this effort and spending all of this money for someone else in a few years. And that may not sound too attractive to him. The money that I might ought to be spending, I'd like to spend on my own place, I'm going to have to spend part of it to keep this up for this widow woman. I don't want to do it. He has a responsibility to do it, but he doesn't want to do it. Well, Boaz is okay with that. He'll do it. Now, our text tells us something that's interesting here about the sandal. says that the man, the custom in their day was that to give evidence to a transaction, that someone would take their sandal off and give it to another person. What is this all about? I don't know. I want us to turn to Deuteronomy 25 and I want us to read a passage that is on this subject. And it's a little different idea, but let's see what happens here. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10. Everybody got it? Deuteronomy 25. When brothers live together, this is the law, okay? This is in Israelite law. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, does that sound like our situation? It does. The wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her to himself as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. See, here's the idea of protecting that family continuity. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gates of the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says that I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders, and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall declare, "Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." There's a lot in common there with our text in Ruth, isn't it? Right? This man, it appears, has a responsibility to do this, but he will not do it. The widow woman is being wronged. The widow woman is being robbed of her right. And the law says she can appeal to the elders of the city. And the elders of the city bring the man forward and say, "Here's what the story is. What do you say?" And if he persists in refusing to fulfill his responsibility, the law says she takes off his sandal, and I don't know if she slaps him in the face with it or not, but it says to spit in his face. That's in the law. To spit in his face and say, "Here's what happens to the man who will treat this widow woman this way in the land of Israel." So where are we at here in the book of Ruth? I'm not sure. There is the part of that phrase says, now it used to be the custom in Israel. So it gives you a little clue that there's a connection there, but it also kind of gives you a little bit of implications that they may have strayed from enforcing laws, just like every country, I suppose, is lax about enforcing some laws and some they're not. But what may be happening is they all know the law. They all know what could happen. They all know what Ruth could do. And it may be that the man is beating her to the punch. The man is saying, "Here's my sandal. I don't want to do it. I give it up." She's not around to spit in his face, which he's probably glad of. But he gives it up voluntarily. Says, "Here it is." I don't know if that's the connection or not, but there is a connection in some way. But the nearest kinsman is not willing to take care of his responsibility. Of course, we know Boaz is. How does that fit our Redeemer? Jesus was ready and willing to make any sacrifice to redeem us, wasn't he? He lived. He knew the type of death that was coming, that faced him. He knew what faced him. He knew the agony that was coming. You remember what he said in the garden? Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, I'm willing. I'm ready to be offered a sacrifice. Number four, the redemption of Ruth is a public act and an undeniable truth. Boaz redeems Ruth in public. Boaz redeems her in the middle of the street, in the middle of the town square. He calls the witnesses there. It's a public meeting. They're not in a closet somewhere. They're not behind closed doors. It's out in the open. Boaz redeems her. He wants witnesses. He wants it to be known, I have redeemed her. They can't deny that it happened. There are too many witnesses that this took place. In a similar way, Christ's redemption of us was a public display. It was done in the open. It was done undeniably. People we know for years have tried to deny. They've tried to write it off. They've tried to say this happened and that happened. Here's what really happened. But no, it didn't. We know, and people know, by people's changed lives, the redeemed person's changed life is a public act. We have been redeemed. And then number five, it is fitting to praise the Redeemer for His graciousness and selfless love. It is fitting to praise the Redeemer for His graciousness and selfless love. The people who were there when Boaz said, I will redeem her, you are witnesses that I have done this. I've redeemed the land. Hear all the witnesses. Hear what I'm saying. I've redeemed her. I will take her to wife. And what did the people say? We are witnesses. But that wasn't all they said. They said, may God, may the Lord make you fruitful. May the Lord bless you, Boaz. May the Lord make your house wealthy and gracious, Boaz. In like manner, it is fitting for not just the church to praise our Redeemer. It is fitting for the world to praise Him. You might say, well, they're not everybody's Christian. It doesn't matter. Somebody might be a voodoo worshiper or whatever, a Hindu, a Muslim, whatever. It is still fitting for them to praise Jesus Christ for redeeming us. It's not just fitting for us who have been recipients of His redemption. It is fitting for the whole, all of creation to praise Him for His act of redemption. Let's pray. Father, we praise You. We do praise You, God. Lord, for what we have received from Your hand. It wasn't certainly because we were so lovely or so beautiful. It wasn't because we loved You. It was because You loved us. Father, may we with all creation extol Your praises. May we declare Your graciousness to us.